This poem weans us from our preoccupation with tombstones by gently refocusing our attention on wind, blindness, cloud, a fiddle rose performing for blades of grass. And after it has marshaled its evidence, the poem ends a little belligerently with a rhetorical question like a dare. Shouldn't we have known the answer all along?
Welcome to The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. This week, we'll be reading Who Will Remain by Abraham Sutzkever. This season of The Stories Jews Tell is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
For the last item in our series, I've selected a poem by Avrom Sutzkever, one of the very great poets of the 20th century. If you have not heard his name before, you're likely to notice it much more often now that you know of him. He's in the process of being discovered beyond the Yiddish public that read him in the original. He's one of those poets whose lives are so exciting that its drama threatens to overshadow their work. Maybe for that reason, Sutzkever never let filmmakers document his life when they wanted to, though two documentaries have been made about him since his death in 2010. I will say just enough to put this poem in context, but there is much more information available through the internet and in books. Justin Kami, for example, professor of literature at Smith College, has just published Sutzkever's memoir and testimony, From the Vilna Ghetto to Nuremberg, which tells about those war years and of that part of his life. Well, Sutzkever was born in Smorgon, Lithuania, in 1913. When the city was ransacked at the beginning of the First World War, in the kind of scenario that has become all too familiar, his family fled to Omsk in Siberia, a region that served as the Russian prison house of exile. His father died there when he was 7 years old. The mother took the family back to the larger city of Vilna because there was nothing left for them in Smorgon. Sutzkever started writing poetry in his teens and became a member of a thriving literary group, Young Vilna. His first major poem, called Siberia, he developed as the myth of his beginnings as a poet when he sees his father's body lowered into its hut in the snowy ground. At that moment, the boy feels the dove that he had been nestling in his bosom flutter to the sky and draw him upward, away from the grave. In this way, Sutzkever recasts Siberia as the magical birthplace of poetry and himself as the Avrom, the Abraham, who comes into Judaism from the snowy north rather than the east. Poetry gave him the possibility of reshaping experience in what seemed like the more meaningful form. Yiddish culture in the 1930s was understandably concerned with hard social and political issues. Hitler in Germany, Stalin in the Soviet Union, poverty, anti-Semitism. The gates were closed to Jews trying to enter Palestine and America. Though Sutzkever was subject to these same conditions, he was often out in the countryside, discovering God's world. He worked hard at poetry, reading everything he could get his hands on in Yiddish and Russian, attending courses on poetry at Vilna's Polish University. Then came the war, trapping him and his new wife in the ghetto, where he continued to write. His wife, Fredke, gave birth to their son, who was instantly murdered. So was Sutzkever's mother and most of Vilna Jewry. As members of the ghetto underground, he and Fredke escaped to the forests to join the partisans. A Lithuanian partisan leader took a sheaf of Sutzkever's ghetto poems and brought them to Moscow and passed them to members of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee in the Soviet Union. They arranged to send a small plane to a makeshift airfield near the forest to bring the Sutzkevers to Moscow in the spring of 1944. There he spoke to thousands, reporting on what had been done to the Jews of Poland. He was then appointed to testify on behalf of Jews at the Nuremberg trials. He made his way back through Poland to Paris and then to Palestine in November 1947, just before the birth of the state. Now, Israel in those years was trying to consolidate its thousands of refugees in a united Hebrew-speaking country. Nonetheless, Sutzkever was able to establish in Tel Aviv the finest literary journal that Yiddish had ever seen. He was invited by Jewish communities everywhere, North and South America, Australia, and South Africa, where he also met with the King of the Zulus. A celebrity wherever he went among Yiddish readers, he lived fairly quietly in Tel Aviv. He never stopped composing poems, not in the ghetto or the forests, and in the early 1970s, he began writing a series of reflective poems that he called Poems from a Diary. At this point, I will turn from that life, which is a more exciting life than many of us would have wished for ourselves, to the even more compelling poetry. The poems from a diary are untitled, so that we know them only by the year they were published and by their opening lines. I've selected an early poem dated 1974, Wer wird bleiben, in this translation by the American writer Cynthia Ozick. So I'll read it first in English and then in the Yiddish original. Who will last? And what? The wind will stay, and the blind man's blindness when he's gone away, and a thread of foam, a sign of the sea, and a bit of cloud snarled in a tree. Who will last, and what? A word as green as Genesis, making grasses grow, and what the prideful rose might mean, seven of those grasses know. Of all that north-flung starry stuff, the star, descended in the tear, will last. In its jar, a drop of wine stands fast. Who lasts? God abides. Isn't that enough? Wer wird bleiben? Was wird bleiben? Bleiben wird der Wind. Bleiben wird die Blindkeit von dem Blinden, was verschwindt. Bleiben wird der Simmen von dem Jamm, a Schnirl schäum. Bleiben wird der Wolkendl, verzeppet auf a Bäum. Wer wird bleiben? Was wird bleiben? Bleiben wird der Traf. Bereichestig, a Reus zu großen, wieder sein Baschaf. Bleiben wird der Fiddelreus, lekovet sich allein. Sieben Großen von die Großen werden sie verstehen. Mehr von alle Sternen, Asch von Zoffen bis aher, bleiben wird der Stern, was erfallt in samme Träer. Ständig wird der Tropen Wein euch bleiben in sein Krug. Wer wird bleiben? Gott wird bleiben. Is dir nicht genug? Let's begin by saying that the question is just what we might have expected. Who will remain? What will be left? These were the most pressing questions after the war. And though they are framed here philosophically, they carry a special urgency for the Yiddish-speaking world of Eastern Europe. Having lost a child, a mother, a formative world, the poet was entitled to think in such terms. And when you're in the field of Yiddish, this question comes at you all the time. What is the future of Yiddish? What will remain? The poet doesn't duck or sidestep these questions. He plunges right ahead with a reply in three stanzas. But it immediately takes us by surprise. The wind will stay, and the blind man's blindness when he's gone away. What kind of answer is that? The wind is precisely what does not stay. Winds are transitory. We say gone with the wind to suggest that nothing remains. The blind man's blindness is even more paradoxical, because the blind man is already missing something valuable. He is missing sight. Rather than reassure us that sight may someday be restored, it's precisely the quality of his blindness that outlasts him, his sightlessness, the dark without the light. One after the other, the poet offers us nature's images of insubstantiality. The sea or the ocean is a mighty force. Had he said that the sea lasts, we would agree that the waters were here before us and will remain after us. Yet here it is not the mighty ocean that endures, but just a string of foam, as when the tide withdraws, washing away the sand castles, the footsteps, sometimes even houses that people have built, leaving only that trace of its having been there. And that Volkendel, Varchepet af a Boim, that Ozick charmingly translates, a bit of cloud snarled in a tree. We imagine the diminutive cloud, scarcely noticeable, caught in the branches as the other larger clouds blow away. The premise of the poem is obviously somber. To wonder what will remain implies that everything else is gone. We're used to apocalyptic movies and books that frighten us with images of the day after and how the world will look in the aftermath of destruction. The question here may be the same, but the tone is very different. It's anything but grim. These answers are gentle and tender, like a lullaby trying to lull a grown-up to sleep. Though we are unsure of their precise meaning, we feel that the poem is meant to reassure us. But how? In what way? The second stanza moves from sight to sound and begins from the ground up. What remains in the world of language, music, poetry? Here is another surprise, because rather than tell us that the best works of literature and music will surely remain, rather than reassure himself that his poetry will remain, the poem promises that music and words will reemerge as they did at the beginning, Bereshisdik, as in Bereshit, in Genesis. Here the Yiddish is so intricate that, brilliant as the translation is, we want to go back to the literal text. It reads, what will remain is a syllable, traf, once again generating creation as it did Bereshisdik at the beginning. What will remain is a fiddle rose in honor of itself that seven grasses of the grasses will understand. The poet creates a new word, aroisgrosen, a neologism that turns grass into a verb, to create out of itself as grass grows from the earth. A syllable is the verbal minimum, suggesting that language is going to begin anew, as organically as emerging grass did in the Bible story of creation. And the next two lines continue this theme of self-contained beauty. Sutzkever had already published a book of poems with the title The Fiddle Rose, which is another of his created words, inviting us to see the physical resemblance between the violin and the long-stemmed rose, the bond of man-made music and beauteous nature. The poem tells us that the fiddle rose plays for its own sake and for the seven grasses that will understand it. Nature's beauties and sounds are there, not for humanity's sake, but for its own. This stanza is even stranger than the first. Why would the poet use such intricate language, yoking and creating new words and concepts, in order to remind us that in the beginning all this wondrous verbal matter arose without our presence? Why challenge us to imagine a fiddle rose, an impossibly hybrid instrument, if the poem wants to point us back to a beginning where there was only a single syllable? We are being redirected from destruction to creation, from what has been lost to what will eternally regenerate itself, and from enormity to the smallest seedlings of life, through the firmness of the rhythm and the closing rhymes that are there in the Yiddish, the poem affirms its faith in the eternal presence of what is cosmically valuable, above and beyond what we human beings have the capacity to appreciate or to understand. From the earthbound second stanza, the poem now lifts our eyes to the vastness of the stars, and in the same way that the image of the fiddle rose yokes the man-made musical instrument to the natural beauty of the flower, here we have a star falling to earth as a human raindrop, a tear. The firmament that sometimes feels so cold and distant is here responding to what happened on earth by descending in the form of a tear. A falling star in Jewish folklore signifies that someone has died. Here the star falls into a tear for humankind. That teardrop reveals that the universe is not so uncaring after all. And then a final surprise. From the heavens to the symbol of human celebration, the keg of wine that we want to drink to the dregs, but can never altogether empty. A single tear from the skies and a single drop of wine in the jug, blending the sorrow and the joy that lead into what now seems like the inevitable conclusion. Can you still ask what remains? Was wird bleiben? Gott wird bleiben. God remains. Isn't that enough? Such a childlike poem, really. So seemingly straightforward that we hardly notice how many expectations it overturns. First and most obviously, its question has already turned our attention from what was lost to what remains. The question implies that it follows some terrible bereavement, and maybe readers approach the poem knowing how great those horrors really were. Yet without a hint of the awfulness that occasions these questions, the poem moves us away from loss to salvation. Next, poetry has always been preoccupied with establishing lastingness in a world of flux. The Romantic poets write much on this theme of impermanence. Shelley reflects on the shattered glory of Ozymandias. Keats's wonderful ode on a Grecian urn tries to capture truth in beauty. This poem follows the Romantic tradition in looking to nature and poetry as the keys to immortality. But rather than focus on time and mutability, it directs us away from ourselves, away from majesty, away from the sublime, to smallness, to remnant, to quintessence. It is filled with what Ozick translates as stuff, not a word about the spirit, and yet it moves us to the soul of matter. We come after civilization has drunk life to the dregs, and we must now experience creation all over again, from the other side of what was there before our civilization existed. But just look at the richness of the language, Yiddish, which we now have to describe these wonders. The poem itself may be the main proof of how much remains. Mainly, I think, the poem overturns our impulse to commemorate through monuments, to establish legacies as insurance of permanence. Survivors of the war published hundreds of memorial volumes, created databases, museum, photograph, and library exhibits. They named institutions, anything, to memorialize the dead. Sutzkever himself, in another series of prose poems, feels that the past is slipping away and he worries, and the dead, have they died? This poem weans us from our preoccupation with tombstones by gently refocusing our attention on wind, blindness, cloud, a fiddle rose performing for blades of grass. And after it has marshaled its evidence, the poem ends a little belligerently with a rhetorical question like a dare. Shouldn't we have known the answer all along? Of the many words the Bible has for Almighty, Jehovah, the Lord of hosts, Yiddish prayer, including the prayer of the Hasidic Rebbes, always prefers the simpler Gott, which may have been adapted from German, but was personalized as the Yiddish Gottenu. This God is both intimate and everlasting. And so here is one final reversal that we might keep in mind. People in the field of Yiddish often describe it as a secular substitute for a religious civilization, as though Hebrew were the language of faith and Yiddish the language of worldliness. The Yiddish term for secular is Weltlich, worldly, but this idea is mistaken. The function of Yiddish was to maintain the Jewish religious civilization, and that remains its function in today's Yiddish-speaking communities that keep their separateness through language as well as dress. Modern Yiddish literature is indeed worldly. Its writers, Sutzkever among them, wrote without obligatory adherence to Jewish belief, and some of its writers were demonstratively unobservant. Yet this poem is enough to remind us that Yiddish was a way of exploring and affirming Jewishness in new ways. With the Psalms the model for Jewish liturgy, every living generation had to record its own experience, and never more so than after the Churban, after the Shoah. Some may say, is this all you have to offer us? These mere hints of an eternal presence for us who were raised on the idea of God's grandeur? Can't you give us anything better against the fear of nothingness? And we notice that even your answer comes in the form of a question. Others, myself included, find something in this affirmation that speaks for us. We savor the signs of God's presence and now know how to look for more of our own signs. God abides. Isn't it enough? I hope that you will agree that this is a good place to pause in telling the stories that Jews tell. We will soon have another chance to reconvene, but for now, happy reading.